4 years ago, before the Bringing Them Home, the Stolen Generation report was published, the St John of God nuns in Broome in northwestern Australia visited local Aboriginal communities and formally apologised for the part they'd played in the tragedy of the Stolen Generations. Many of the children educated at the Catholic missions at Lombardina and Beagle Bay, or at the Holy Child Orphanage in Broome, had been taken from their families because they had mixed blood. Others, who were full blood, were taught by the nuns but had their families close by. The mostly Irish St John of God nuns were an intrepid bunch who travelled to Eagle Bay in 1907, lashed to the deck of a pearling lugger, the only access to the isolated mission for many years. When Siobhan McHugh met the nuns and their former pupils in Broome recently, she found that their relationship was deep, honest and complex. It also revealed a lot about the nature of black-white relations in an assimilationist era.
To me, they were surrogate mothers when I was growing up. When I left school and began work, they were more like really special friends. The thing that they stressed to us always, that, you know, you are as good as, if not better, than everyone else. It is up to you. You know, to what? And I grew up with a very, very positive outlook on life because of that.
And when it was St. Patrick's Day at Beagle Bay, we were looking forward for 17th of March to come because we knew we'd have a holiday that day, you know.
Would you sing Irish songs?
Yeah. Hello, dear St. Patrick, dear Saint of our Isle. On us thy poor children give us a big smile. And oh, what high in thy mansions above, for God and St. Patrick and our native land.
So they must have really drummed those songs into you.
Yeah. I'm 75, 76 now, and I still got it here.
As Esther Bevan and Vera Dan, who was singing there, can recall, the Irish nuns made a huge impression around Broome and Beagle Bay. Jimmy Chai, another ex-pupil, even wrote them into his hit musical Brand New Day. Somewhat marginalised within the church, they lived as frontier women in an isolated environment. As a result, they interacted with the Aboriginal community on a human, practical level, their priorities often different from those demanded by church or government policy. Full-blood students like Esther and Vera moved with relative ease between the black and white worlds. But for others, the nuns' love could never adequately compensate for the real mothers they'd lost. Phyllis Bin Barker and Daisy Howard were stolen from the East Kimberley as toddlers. Phyllis grew up in the orphanage at Broome. At 18, she was working in the native hospital in Derby when she heard she had a visitor.
It just happened that my mother came once to see me, but she was hurt, I could understand. She was upset. After being taken from a small age and going to see her as an adult, well, she said she wasn't her daughter. You know, with all the hardship and the loss of her child, I suppose she felt it very bad that way, you know, and she never talked about it.
Did she get upset? Did she just say, you're not my daughter? Or did she look at you?
She just looked at me and said, you're not my daughter. It's a long time, you know. I mean, taking a child away at a small age and then going back to see the mother as an adult, well, she would be shocked, I suppose, thinking, oh, you're not my daughter. But that was the first and the last I've seen her. She didn't even let the other old people knew about she had another daughter because it hurt her. She was broken up inside and she never mentioned she had another daughter. It's just recently when the people say, who's your mum and all this and that, they always say, oh, she never said anything about it. She never told us. Well, I said, because she was upset and she had a broken heart. That's how she went to her grave, with a broken heart.
And do you know who is your father?
It took a long time before I knew when I got my son got my papers from the welfare. Yeah, my father was, he ran the station out of Derby. But in the meantime, he would come up and down. But as I was growing up, he used to be around the orphanage. I don't know why, though. But never spoke to him or anything like that.
Do you think he came to the orphanage to try and see you?
I don't think so, no. I don't know what was in his heart. I don't know how he felt.
And do you have any memory of when you were taken?
I don't have nothing. I can't remember a thing, really.
Did you ever manage to hang on to anything about Aboriginal culture?
No. Well, I lost all that when I was taken away. And till today, I don't know anything about Aboriginal culture. We lost our homeland, we lost our parents, we lost our culture.
And so tell me about the orphanage then. So you were brought in at the age of 3.
Well, with the nuns, well, I must say they were very good towards us. They didn't have much, but they tried to give us what they could. It was hard in those days for the nuns. They battled very hard. They taught us a lot. They taught us how to sew, how to be clean within ourselves, how to grow up, look after your own children. They showed us how to cook, wash, iron, and I'm very grateful for that. Today, I still do that and look after the house, the house mother, keep everything spotless. That's the teaching that they gave us, and I really appreciate that. They tried to comfort us and gave us everything and made us happy, and that's how we grew up. We never worry about anything else. The main thing was we had a roof over the head, we had clean beds to lie on, we had food, and their love from the nuns.
We gave them the best of what we had. We never gave them second best. Okay, the best of what we had was, in our eyes now, certainly not what they should have had, but it was the best of what was there.
Sister Pat Rattigan.
When I first came as a postulant or whatever, then I started working at the Holy Child Kindergarten. There was a kindergarten there. Then the big kids minded the little kids like you did in a family, and everybody kind of looked after... looked after everybody. And at mealtime, they didn't have any more or less than what we had. So, yeah, you bonded together naturally, I think. And I saw that again in Lombardina. I was, 19 in Lombardina. And on Sunday, like, life was really regimented because the priests controlled everything. And on a Sunday, for example, the boys would always go out in the one vehicle that was mission truck with the priest, so they never had to walk. The girls had to walk. And you'd have to be fully clothed in your long black stockings and black shoes and veil and everything, you know, whatever. And I remember at 19 being responsible for these girls. When we get out there or whatever, and I get under a train, I'd take the little ones, so they'd leave the little ones with me. And we'd have a bit of water, and that's all we would have, you know. So we were dependent on the bigger girls finding us something to eat, you know. It was their job to find some berries and fish, and they usually did, and bring it back and thing. If they didn't, well, none of us ate.
Did it ever occur to you to question why people were taking children away from their parents?
No, I don't think it did. Religious life didn't allow for that. You only had that hour of recreation in the evening. You didn't access newspapers, and you weren't allowed to listen to the wireless. So there was never an open debate. They were, I think, as women, we reacted to kids that came and we took them, cared for them, loved them, grew them up, but really didn't know, even ourselves or the other sisters, much about the wider world, what was going on out there. So we would have heard that the kids were there for education. I suppose how they got there, we didn't question.
Faith of our Father's holy faith, we will be true to thee till death. Our heart beat high with joy whenever. glorious words, faith of our father's holy faith.
No, I can't remember my mother. I was taken from her when I was about two or three. I'm just going by my welfare papers now, what I got. And taken to Mooloopla, and I haven't seen my mother again, never again. My sister and brother were older than me. I was the youngest. There's another half-caste brother, so both of us were taken. And the other two just stayed with the... And then, 68 or 9, I went back up there. That's when I seen my sister for the first time in Halls Creek. And we're really shy, too, for each other, you know, sort of. Not close in a way, you know.
And did your sister ever tell you how your mother felt about you being taken from her, you and your brother?
No, she said that she can't remember. She said all of a sudden we wasn't there. You know, we didn't even know where you was taken. When they took me, I could speak my language, but we just lost it. There's no one to talk to and keep up our, you know, language and culture and everything. We just lost everything. And that's what I'm really sorry about, you know, not when I see little kids that age now talking and things, I just always think back for what, you know, what I used to, like what I lost, you know. I feel really sad about it.
So when you went to Beagle Bay, what was it like being brought up by the nuns? I mean, did you, as a child, can you remember how you felt?
They really made us feel that we were part of a sort of family, you know? I mean, we felt really good. I'm still lonely, and sometimes I can remember crying ourselves to sleep, you know, just, but we got on really well with everyone, you know? We loved the nuns. We had jobs to do, like we used to go milking in the morning, work in the gardens, and I worked at the hospital for a little while. Oh, things like that, you know, just, I didn't see them really hard, you know, nuns. When we had our own children, then we knew what to do, you know, so I think that gave us a good start to when we got married and had our family. I think that was the good start for us, you know, to have someone there for us.
And so when you go back to where you were originally from, do you still feel a sense of connection to that country?
I do, yeah. When I go back there, I just, you know, I still feel it. I cry too. Like I say, I would rather be brought up that way and knowing everything than being brought up the other way and not knowing anything, you know. I think it hurts more to know now what happened, because, I mean, there's nothing we can do, really.
And if you went back to live there, would you live in the Aboriginal way or the Western kind of European Catholic way? Would you do things the traditional custom way or not?
No, I think I'll always do my, you know, be a Catholic, no? You know, do my, just live in my, like in town and, you know, sort of go to church and things like that. I don't think I'll ever forget that, you know. Although I really like to go out. I went a few times with the people from the language center. I mean, I just pick up a few words here and there, you know, like my Aboriginal name. Janyali is my Aboriginal name.
Do you think you could fit back in out there in Halls Creek now?
Yeah, I do. I go back there a lot of times. I go back every year. And I fit in really well with everyone there. A lot of them just saying to me, come back home. And I just think to myself, well, where's home, you know? I mean, I know home is there. But I'm sort of between two culture or what, because my children are here. They were all born in Broome, mostly, you know. I mean, I suppose if we were younger, we could have still go back and, you know, sort of feel better by just living with them. I would really love to live in the bush with my old, you know, with my mother. But now, you know, we got to live this life now. And the only way we'll ever know is we don't know the other one.
System is a fiendish contradiction that submerges little blackies in the night. Our foreign values, and I'd really love to tell you that it's wrong to make everybody white. They take wogs, dings and dagos, and people from Tobago, and mix and progenies and slobs and coons, hoping that in education we might build a whiter nation, and that person is the nation's greatest boon.
I think the sense of that time was that if these kids were going to get anything, they had to get education and they had to understand white ways and they had to, yeah, I suppose in a way they had to be white clones in lots of ways. I don't think we ever thought that or put it out. I know the kids had to speak English because that was the thing that was going to get them somewhere. And also that the government required that the missions were supposed to be educating, they were supposed to be westernising or growing up these kids, not for any, they were to grow them up as a working class, to give them some, and that was what happened all around Australia. They were to be working class people, you know, they were to know enough English and enough education, not too much education, because they would get smart blacks, that was the term, you know. In other words, they would challenge the authority.
When you say they weren't to get too much education, did you ever feel personally a pang about that? You know, if you had a bright girl or something and you could really see that she had a thirst for knowledge?
In Beagle Bay, when I went to Beagle Bay, by that time the Palatine Centre was operating at Ross Moyne, and the brighter ones did have the opportunity. And, I mean, I saw sisters like Sister Catherine teaching those kids on Saturday and giving, you know, doing plays like she had them here in Broome doing Shakespeare. You know, Jimmy Chai, those ones, Brand New Day is really based on, I mean, we have no animosity for Brand New Day. It's true, there's a lot of story in truth in Brand New Day. But any kids who had any inclination that they wanted to or were any way bright got the chance to go down to Ross Moyne. The sisters there, what they were doing was really pushing education all the time, pushing the health of the kids so they get good health, they grow up properly. And I think that push all the time to get them out of the lower rung was there.
I can always remember, we are training you, we are teaching you, so you one day will be here and you will take control of your life and you'll be running and managing your own affairs. That just was rammed down my throat by the John of Gods. And I have, no matter where I've been, the words keep ringing in my ears, you know, you are as good as, if not better, you know. And I feel that to me is the greatest gift they gave me. I won a scholarship and I went to the Palatine Centre in Ross Moyne. I was then with the Native Welfare Department. I was based in Perth for 2 years, and then for the next couple of years I was based in the old office in Halls Creek. I was the first Aboriginal person up here to be employed in the government. So it has gotten better, much better over the years. But yes, I often think that when I'm working with people now who are dysfunctional or who are really struggling, I think, yes, that was set in place by all those policies all those years ago, and I was one of those people who enforced it, being that public servant there, yes. Like, I've had people come into the office and apply to get married, and it was up to either one of us three in the office, whoever was there at the time, to determine how much, is it white blood? They could tell you the caste, you know, you are a half caste, three-quarter caste, you know, depending on how much white blood you had in you. We could go down to the 16th.
And was there a formula who was allowed to marry who according to how much blood?
Yes, yes. Oh, if they were suitable and if they, you know, we thought that they were responsible people, and things like... I didn't think about it then, no. I just accepted it because it was part of my job. It wasn't until very much later that I looked back. And when I share with people, I say, you know, I did at one stage look back and say, my God, I was one of those people that had to grade them, if you like.
Did you have to get permission when you married your white husband?
No, at that stage then it was all of that was over. The referendum had come in and the citizenship rights and that were, you know, we were given equal status in Australia. So no, I didn't need that, no.
And do you remember how you felt when that referendum happened? When you got equal rights and you were suddenly now, you know... The first Australians were now allowed to be Australian citizens.
Actually, I felt good. I think, oh, thank God, we're not part of the unique flora and fauna anymore. We are people in our own right. And from then, I think Aboriginal people, very slowly at first, then really started to look into taking control of their lives.
I feel sad at times not meeting my mother, especially my mother, but in the long run now that I've grew up and I had my own children and I battled hard with my children, so what was more concern was my children. I battled hard for them, I didn't get any help from anyone, so it was like that's all that I've got is my children. That's the happiness I've got from all that. My children come first. And I think it's a wonderful thing to have children. I just had my children, looked after them, gave them caring and everything, but I didn't spoke about my background because I never knew anything about it. As soon as the minute you talk about these things, some of the Europeans say, oh, you know, bullshit and all things like that. And that hurts us, you know. My dad didn't go through it. And that was the government policy, and I think that the government should recognise these things. But the Prime Minister don't understand anyway.
When the word came that we were to celebrate the Jubilee, and we said, well, we really didn't think we should celebrate, you know, because we have done, you know, things in the Stolen Generation, whatever. So we said, we'll ask the people. But we had something public in which we publicly apologised. And that was our way of saying, well, I mean, it was a terribly, terribly wrong thing. That no matter what, it should never have happened. No child should be taken from their mother. And the way we judged people in the white and black and all that kind of thing. The negative role of missions, of bosses, of putting the church in powerful situations... But the church was part of the society of the time. They certainly weren't in any way worse. Good things have happened. People like Esther have had, you know, good education, and some of the leaders now are the ones who got education. But I think there must have been another way.
How did the people react when you went round 4 years ago and apologised?
Oh, fantastic. It was, it was a lot of sharing, personal emotion. Anger from some people, you know. There are some people who, you know, are really hurt and really angry. Some of the girls in the orphanage, why were they there? And all of those kind of things. It was a wonderful thing that happened. And I think it was accepted as genuine because it was done by the sisters, the way they're doing things now in a kind of quiet, a different way. And it was done before it was fashionable to do it. But I think the terrible legacies, we'll never really know the depth of them because they broke up families, they disempowered people. If it was turning back the clock in time and you were able to do it, we must never and should never have done it or participated in it.
You know, I know there's a lot of people, you know, saying sorry. I mean, that is real good. Well, why not the government? That's the part. And they're the responsible people for what happened to us. We don't blame the nuns. But a lot of people think that nuns and, like, the missions, priests and everyone, no, we don't see it that. I mean, it wasn't the nuns or priests and them, you know, that took us. Not the church, really. It's the government. Even now, I used to feel shy even to walk out of my house before, bring up my children. I should be always home. And I still feel like that today. I mean, I'm not blaming anybody for, you know, for that sort of thing, but I'm just saying, like, it never give us confidence. Well, I know a lot of times that I used to want to work, but I really didn't know how to start, you know, how to get on, like, to talk to anybody and things like that. And I see everyone else like that, like, we all shy kind of people are. Yeah, yeah. We can't talk up for ourselves. Just like we felt we wasn't, I don't know, not wanted might be, or I don't know. It's hurting them just to say sorry. But, I mean, what hurt we going through, you know, it's everyday thing for us. Everyday thing, you know, sometimes we can sit up and talk, think to ourselves, you know, what could have been, you know. We'd be happy there. We most probably would be, because we'd have our family with us. And, yeah, all of a sudden, you know, we're just taken, and there's no one responsible for it. And why did they do it in the first place? You know, you can think about it over and over, you get no answer, really.
Why are you crying, my pretty Colleen? Why are your eyes filled with tears?
Like to fix my mother's grave, for start. She's buried in Derby, but she's thrown in the bush. I mean, they're not animals. Put a tombstone or something there that but can't do it.
Closer, come closer. Don't throw me away. I am so tired and so blue. I'm dreaming of someone so far, far away, and sharing these memories.
Would it help you in any way if the Prime Minister were to say sorry?
It would, but he's got to realize and understand these things. If anyone would happen to take his children away, how would he feel? Exactly the same how we felt with our mothers, you know? And not seeing them again, I mean, it would be a big worry to you. I mean, most people can go silly, lose their memory. It's very hard to take your children away from you. That's half of you.
I still remember the old mission yard. The old days, the old ways, the times that were hard. The friends of my childhood when I was young. The father, the old Irish nuns. So just come one step closer, don't throw me away, and carry me back to my town by the bay when the dawn.
Reconciliation, if we're talking about reconciliation, starts with me and you. And the groundswell is just ever widening in this country of ordinary people on the ground. So bugger the government.
When the darkness is falling and passing of this war.
That report featured four Aboriginal former pupils of the St John of God nuns in Broome and Beagle Bay, Phyllis Bin Barker and Daisy Howard, who were stolen from their mothers in the East Kimberley as toddlers, and Esther Bevan and Vera Dan, who came from the Beagle Bay area in the West Kimberley. You also heard Sister Pat Rattigan, a St John of God nun from the East Kimberley and current Dean of the University of Notre Dame in Broome, possibly the only campus in the country where a unit of Aboriginal history is mandatory for every undergraduate. The music came from Brand New Day, a new show written by Jimmy Chai, who was also taught by the nuns. That report was produced by Siobhan McHugh.